live from the Poly Market Studio in L.A. It's the Young Turks.
Gettysburg, wow.
Oh, my God.
Begah!
Welcome, one and all, to the first hour. Young Turks Power Panel. I am John Iadarola. Cenk isn't here. Deal with it. We're going to deal with it. Me and in studio, Jordan Yule, presenter on Rebel HQ, podcaster, all around great guy, activist. Add other things if you'd like. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, John.
Thanks. And Francesca, who we tried to get in studio, but she's got other things she does and kids and everything. Francesca Fiorentini, host of the Bituation Room. Thank you for being here.
Sure, you're welcome. Wow.
In any event, very glad to have you both here because we've got a lot of stuff to talk about. Some incredibly important news, some social chaos sweeping the nation, developments in Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York, all around other bad news. And do the Democrats want to kill Donald Trump? We'll be debating that to close out this hour. But thank you in advance of all that for being here. We have a lot planned. There's gonna be an awesome second hour as well. And with that, why don't we jump into the news? Protests and demonstrations in support of those being attacked in Gaza have swept the nation, now taking place at college campuses in every corner of the country. And at most of them, there is some significant pushback from the administration, from counter-protesters, and from police as well. At Emory University in Atlanta, two faculty members were actually arrested yesterday as they were trying to stop police from attacking students. So as context, there was a encampment of about a dozen tents that had been set up around 7:30 in the morning. And just a few hours later, it had already been dispersed by the Atlanta Police Department and Georgia State Patrol officers, apparently, according to reports, using both tear gas and rubber bullets against the encampment that had been there for about 3 hours at that point. For context, and as we said, it involved not just the police and students, but professors as well. Take a look at this. The woman you see there being slammed to the ground shouting, "I am a professor," is indeed Emory economics professor Carolyn Folan. And that incident was described by police as battery. But I want to be very clear. They did not describe what they did to her as battery. They apparently charged her with battery against the police officers. Perhaps something happened outside of the bounds of that video later on while she was being detained. Apparently she was jailed for 11 hours. But if that is the incident, then this definitely needs to be looked into, because there was needless violence doled out there. Why that woman who was just asking what they were doing to the cops needed to have her face slammed down on the concrete, I don't necessarily understand. But if you were going to attempt to describe what she did to them as battery, you should hopefully have to answer to someone for that. Now, we have a lot more, obviously, but Jordan, what do you make of this?
It's disgusting. I mean, we've seen the White House, we've seen members of Congress decry and denounce all of these protests when these are college students, professors, allies showing up to call for peace. What we saw before this were students, members of the faculty meeting, celebrating, having a Seder together across different campuses, calling for peace, and they're met with state violence. You're seeing the cops lie about what happened. This isn't new. This is just what they do because they don't expect people with the camera to be there. And as these charges and these arrests continue to mount up, there is a need for support. So I put together a site, campusbailfunds.com. In one list, you can click and find ways to donate to all of these different student groups all over the country and a national bail fund, because they're going to need support, they're going to need help, and if they're still going to continue with their encampments, they're going to need supplies. So campusbailfunds.com, you could help out all of these protesters.
Francesca?
God, I love you, Jordan. You're so great at this. Jordan springs into action. I just spring into sheer anger and rage at what is happening. You know, one of the other pieces of misinformation is not just that this professor assaulted a police officer, but it is that these protests that are spreading across the country are somehow anti-Semitic. We know that that is a lie, and yet it's something that's been echoed by this administration, this Democratic administration. So I just keep on pouring through my mind the ways that Joe Biden and leading Democrats have told us that democracy is at stake, and yet here we have their line is sort of no different than the cops' line, than the university's line. The police, the administrators, and the White House are all in lockstep on this. Mike Johnson is using Columbia as a place to do stump speeches, right? I mean, it is wild to me how students have been abandoned. And lastly, think about these students, where they've come from. Maybe they were in 12th grade when George Floyd was murdered. They were in 11th grade. That was their first protest ever, right? 2020. Then what happens? They go out, maybe they got arrested then, or they got brutalized, or their friend did, right? That's incredibly politicizing. Then what happened? 2021 January, right? They see a bunch of boat dads storm the Capitol, and they're being now defended basically by the Supreme Court, right? They might not, like a lot of the Jan Sixers, might get off, right? Then they've been in the pandemic, they've had to remote school. Suddenly a genocide is taking place. It's on all their social media feeds, right? They see it every day, and yet the media and mainstream politicians are telling them it's not what they're seeing. This is not actually genocide. In fact, you're anti-Semitic for saying so. Then they take to their own campuses, and their administrators and the cops and the political establishment throw them under the bus. This is wildly radicalizing. This is incredibly politicizing. And I will say to those students, let this moment politicize you. I think it's important. And you see that by doing this kind of repression, all the cops and politicians and university leaders are doing is ensuring there will be more and more and more of this.
Yeah, 100%. And we'll talk in a little bit about there are multiple reasons why I think the crackdown is happening as fast and as violent as it is. We'll certainly talk about that. But none of this should be new. College campuses are places for this sort of activism. It happens. There are tent encampments from time to time. And I'm not just saying that the students are surprised that the violence is so quick. You could see in those professors who might have been there for years, decades, they were shocked at what they were seeing, because they've certainly been there for other protests that did not receive this sort of, again, state sanctioned crackdown. And I don't just mean like Georgia State, I mean the US government, as you pointed out, Mike Johnson and other Republicans, to distract from the positions that they hold in regard to the genocide, are attempting to point the finger at the students to say, oh, no, I understand that we're totally fine with all these people being murdered. Don't think about that. Think about the fact that these people are anti-Semitic. And as you pointed out, wild overcharacterization. There have been some signs that were either threatening of violence or anti-Semitic. There have been some statements that have been made by some people. No protest, no social movement has ever been capable of being 100% pure if it lets anyone in, anyone can get involved. You meet over and over again, hundreds, thousands of people involved. If you only need to care about what people are saying when every single one of them says exactly what you're okay with and exactly in the way you're okay with, then no social movement in American history has ever reached that bar, nor will it, conveniently, because they don't want it to. So, and in this case, there are no even accusations at Emory University of those sorts of things happening. And this is not a case where they had had this encampment for 2 weeks and they're disrupting classes and the campus is shut down. It had been there for 3 hours. The vast majority of students probably hadn't even seen it yet and they were already cracking down on it. Now, as I said, I do want to talk about the motivations a little bit, but before we go to that, I do want to give you another voice from on the campus, the chair of the school's philosophy department, Noel McAfee, here talking with Democracy Now!
And then I saw in front of me a student on the ground with three or four policemen pummeling the student, just pummeling and pummeling. And I tried to video it. I was standing there about 3 feet away from it. And it went on for like a minute or two. And I said, screamed, "What are you doing?" And then they stopped pummeling the student. And a policeman stood in front of me and said, "You need to leave." And I felt like the person who just needed to stay and witness what had just happened. And so I stood there several feet away, and then he started dragging me off and putting my hands behind my back and took me in.
I'm so sorry. Is there anything I can do for you right now?
Yes, can you call the philosophy department office and tell them I've been requested?
Philosophy department?
Yes, call the philosophy department office.
And I love that, like, there is so much fear amongst those in charge of like the political status quo that young people are like, they're being manipulated. They're seeing things on the TikToks or whatever. They have this wild idea of what our government is like. Why do they think we're like this? Let's bash their skulls in. Let's drag their professors away. I kind of feel like you're making the content for them at this point. And TikTok isn't banned yet. They're still gonna see it. So anyway, for me, what we're seeing at the individual college campus is obviously unacceptable. But the fact that the reaction seems to be driven less by genuine fear about what's being said and more about like the campus, like the professor of Emory or the higher ups, they must be terrified that if these protests continue for a few days, for a week, they're gonna get called into Congress. They're gonna be told to resign. They're gonna lose their jobs because, you know, Patricia Fox and Mike Johnson and Marjorie Greene are performatively losing their mind about these protests as a distraction from what they're doing and not doing. So at all levels, this is absolutely horrendous. But Francesca, give me your thoughts about all this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this speaks to this speaks to, I think, the Palestine exception when it comes to freedom of speech. It's the Palestine exception when it comes to human rights. It's the Palestine exception when it comes to anything, right? And every liberation movement has had that. Every liberation movement, it's all good, you know? Don't talk about South Africa like that, you know? Don't talk about Vietnam like that. I mean, each kind of liberation movement has had this amount of pushback. But I just, at a moment when we've covered on TYT the attacks on intellectualism, generally academia, colleges, you know, higher learning, the right loves to dismantle it. Except never before have we seen leading Democrats give them hammers with which to dismantle it. Mm-hmm. You see the same, you know, Democratic mayors, you know, Eric Adams do the same things that, you know, Republican politicians like Governor Greg Abbott does. Like the same kinds of things are saying, yeah, go after our elite institutions, go after the presidents because they can't properly define intifada as anti-Semitic, which it is not. Actually, fundamentally. And these professors and these administrators, not professor, the administrators are crumbling. I am floored that they haven't even, have they not watched TYT? I mean, have they not watched any Republican right-wing news? Do they know what's going on? Do they know how bad faith they're gonna twist your words and take you out of context? It's time to have a little bit of a backbone, but they don't have one. So I am astounded at how much the students have been hung out to dry here. And I am scared for what this means for not only November, but for higher learning and education broadly. What I am not scared of, however, is the movement for liberation for Palestinians. Look, I was a student activist in the year 2003, 2002, started against the Iraq War. Our administration wasn't, you know, allowing the NYPD to arrest us en masse. We did that elsewhere. But, you know, at that time, calling for divestment from Palestine was definitely not popular. Now, after 34,000 plus civilians have been killed in a genocide, it is spreading like wildfire. So I do have hope that one day we will attain some amount, the end of the occupation and some amount of liberation for the Palestinian people. But I think there is a long and scary road ahead, and especially when it comes to our own civil rights here at home.
Yeah, I never want to hear about campus free speech from the right ever again. This was your moment. This was your moment to stand up and speak up and show that you're committed to this as an actual principle rather than a slogan. You know, Greg Abbott prided himself on defending campus free speech for conservatives. You could see it in his statement when he signed that bill. What's he doing this week? By the order of Texas, under him, they're bashing and beating protesters and members of the media for even covering it. They arrested a cameraman for a local Fox affiliate in Austin just for being there. The idea that the right genuinely cares about campus free speech is ludicrous. But it was funny to see Matt Walsh, who was apparently too stupid to get the memo that, oh, this only benefits our side, question Abbott's actions, question the University of Texas and police officers in Texas, question their actions. Like, whoa, wait, whoa, I thought we cared about free speech. Matt, you are too stupid to realize this, but you're in a position where you only defend it for the right. And I hope this helps you going forward. But it's just totally disingenuous. The whole thing is an absolute charade.
I want to turn to an angle of this that might make you even more angry, potentially. Let's jump to this. Donald Trump has to make the student protests, like everything else in this country, about him. And so he decided to do that with this comparison between the protests we're currently seeing over what's going on in Gaza with another protest, one you might remember. He posted on Truth Social, "Crooked Joe Biden would say constantly that he ran because of Charlottesville. Well, if that's the case, he's done a really terrible job, because Charlottesville is like a peanut compared to the riots and anti-Israel protests that are happening all over our capital C country right now. And it's Crooked's fault because he sends the wrong message every single time. The fact is that Crooked Joe Biden hates Israel and hates the Jewish people. The problem is that he hates the Palestinians even more, and he just doesn't know what to do."
I mean, I guess if he did hate everybody on either side, he would be confused about it. You seem a little bit more confused about it, buddy. I understand that you're very tired these days. I thought you were catching up in the courtroom on your sleep. But he right there wants to have his cake and eat it too. So he has to say that Joe Biden hates Israel and the Jewish people, because that's what the right is saying, even though Joe Biden has barely questioned the military strategy at all for months and months and months. Except at the same time, he wants young voters to abandon Joe Biden, and they don't like him because he's not helping the Palestinians. So he has to pretend that he hates Palestinians more. So which is it? Which of them does he hate the most? But anyway, set that aside. Charlottesville was like a peanut. A peanut. I remember Charlottesville. Do you watching this remember Charlottesville? Maybe he's hoping that you don't. In case you don't, here's a little reminder of some of what it looked like. Now, I don't know exactly which part of that is the peanut. When the Nazis drove into a crowd trying to kill as many people as they possibly could and successfully killing Heather Hare. I don't know if that murder by Nazis in America was a peanut. I don't know if the group of all of those guys dressed identically marching with torches about how the Jews will not replace us, if that's the peanut, if the entire thing is a peanut. I do know that there's very fine people on both sides. I remember that. So the idea that Joe Biden isn't doing what he should in comparison to these protests, we can make the argument about that. Maybe he should be out there showing solidarity with the students. I think that would be pretty awesome. Yep. But for Donald Trump to criticize the effect that a president can have on protests when he did PR for Nazis that had already murdered someone. I think he could probably just let this one pass by without giving his two cents. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, deep down, they all know there is no comparison. But congrats to everybody, Republicans, Democrats, AIPAC, members of the media, for comparing these two, for allowing the comparison of these two events to flourish, to create the environment by decrying all pro-ceasefire, John, sorry to your chagrin, pro-Palestinian protests as anti-Semitic. Knowing that is totally disingenuous, knowing that is maybe picking out a couple of outliers and using them to describe an entire group, an entire movement, by denouncing it as anti-Semitic. Treating those claims as serious leads to moments like this, where somebody who, a group of his own supporters, marches in Charlottesville to intimidate, to threaten, to harass members of the Jewish community, to forward a great replacement conspiracy theory. For that condition, you created this. AIPAC, Democrats, Republicans, members of the media, by pushing this idea that these protests are unilaterally anti-Semitic. It's an absolute farce and they know it, but they're doing it anyway.
Yep, John Fetterman also tweeted exactly that. That this makes Charlottesville look like nothing. I mean,
that's insane.
That is the most anti-Semitic thing I have heard this entire time, is the grand flattening of anti-genocide protesters and our complicity in it, and the amount of US taxpayer dollars going to it, and neo-Nazis marching. But man, you guys, look at the flanks of cops just, you know, throwing them to the ground. The tiki torches went out. No, man, we all remember that that didn't happen. Because again, remember what the cops do and remember who they protect, all right? And if you need evidence, look at what's going on campus and look at how the Charlottesville protesters were allowed to go about their merry way. And the next day, both sides were also repressed. Specifically, the anti-fascist side was repressed by the cops. Look, about Donald Trump, he's gonna do what he's gonna do. To me, that bleat is perfect evidence of the ways that the Democratic Party has allowed the Republicans to actually edge them out on Israel, because they actually have no vision. They could easily say and stand up for the protesters. They could easily condition the amount of military aid. My God, how many more aid workers, how many more children need to be murdered by Israel for you to stop sending them weapons? Christ. Like you could do something, anything, but instead, no. Again, anti-Semitic, from the river to the sea, any slogan you want, that's what they're going to do. And so they've left a window open for Republicans to actually capitalize on, right? Because who's gonna be more bloodthirsty than Republicans? Nobody. Democrats can't do that. It's just like, at this point, Trump is just what Joe Biden is, but again, more bloodthirsty, more open with it. And so notice the one point in that little statement that he made that said, I guess he hates Palestinians more. Ooh, that kind of stings, right? Because that's Donald Trump saying, even though Joe Biden hates Israel, I guess he hates Palestinians more. That's him nodding and winking, because he knows deep down that Joe Biden's absolutely greenlit this entire genocide and shows no signs of slowing down.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, we're gonna take a little short break. When we come back, lots more news to get to. Don't go anywhere, we'll be right back. Welcome back, one and all. Thank you for being here. And if you are just joining us now, please hit the like button, because we've got a lot of fascinating news to get into. Let me provide an example. Trump sure seemed to think that his criminal trial in New York would become like a 24/7 Trump rally, flooded with his loyal followers waiting outside of the courtroom to hang on his every word about what Turley had written about him and how cold it was or whatever. But regardless, that's not how it's worked out. There's a few random people wearing Trump t-shirts or waving flags and stuff like that, but not the crowd that he had hoped for. And I think because of that, because of how unacceptable that is to Trump, he has decided to reject reality and come up with his own fantasy land that's better for him ideologically. So he's been truthing recently things like this. The courtroom area in Lower Manhattan is in a complete lockdown mode, not for reasons of safety, but because they don't want any of the thousands of MAGA supporters to be present. If they did the same thing at Columbia and other locations, there would be no problem with the protesters. That's the most recent one. He had also said, I'm at the heavily guarded courthouse. Security is that of Fort Knox. Also, that MAGA will not be able to attend this trial, presided over by a highly conflicted pawn of the Democrat Party. It is a sight to behold. Getting ready to do my courthouse presser, 2 minutes. It's more of a depressor, honestly. But anyway, that's just, but none of that's true. It's not in full lockdown mode. And by the way, let's say that it was. Let's say that it was. He says it wouldn't be for safety. I will remind you, a person has already taken their life outside of that courtroom. So if you were the cops and you wanted to go crazy, you would at least have a good cover story for doing that. But they're not. As pointed out by Caitlin Collins, who has been to the site of the courtroom, the courthouse is open to the public. The park outside, where a handful of his supporters have gathered on trial days, is easily accessible. It's not walled off. They're just not coming. And he, in the same way that, like, you might remember when he was inaugurated, they had a crowd. And there was an okay crowd, but it was smaller than Obama had had. So they just photoshopped it and lied. I will never understand a person who is so opposed to what is real. He cannot admit that it just didn't work out. And honestly, why would it? It's one thing to go to an inauguration speech. You're super excited that Donald Trump just got elected. You're super excited for the end of democracy and everything. So you go to the inauguration speech. But what do you go into the courthouse for? You hear him talk for a minute or two about how he's not gonna be with Melania for her birthday. And then it's 8 hours of him being in the building. Why would you go? I'm not surprised they're not showing up. And I guess I can't be that surprised that he's lying about it. What do you think?
It's hilarious. I kind of wish we can go back in time and meet younger Trump, like pre-famous Trump. Just the lies he must have told could have been spectacular. It's unfortunate social media, and we didn't live in a digital age at that time, because he was probably the funniest person in New York. It just inventing a reason why people aren't showing up for boring, drawn out, protracted legal hearings. Like, oh, it was gonna be so sick, but they had to lock it down. So we couldn't do anything. You kind of have to love it. Like, someone who's so committed to lying like that, at some point it stops being ridiculous and starts being really funny.
Yeah, it's with Trump, it's always funny until the moment he gets into power and you're like, ah, yeah, this sucks. Rats. I really hate this punchline. For me, I just think I blame Johnny Depp. Like, we all know that Johnny Depp had a massive crowd outside of very crazed Pirates of the Caribbean fans. And Trump clearly watched all of that and was like, I want that. Get me in the new Pirates.
He's got the makeup.
Do I need a drink? A drink. He's got the makeup, exactly. I need more eyeliner. Like, but truly, that like set the bar. And I do feel like there's a little bit of him that's like mad that this isn't televised, because like the Johnny Depp trial was the best thing that happened to court TV since OJ. And so I feel like Trump's also like, maybe we should just let the cameras in. At least they would do him more justice than whoever drew him. Like, what was that?
That was
like very upsetting.
Good art. We don't get the cameras there. I am now fascinated by the idea of us being able to get a window into him as a younger man.
Yeah.
Like, they don't make young Sheldon, make young Donald. It would be amazing.
No.
But just like to think about, like, he was the president. We have these myths of our early presidents, and then this is what we're left with. I just imagine him like, I didn't chop down the cherry tree. It was someone else, maybe a Democrat. Could have been Nancy Pelosi. Definitely conflicted X-Man.
It's all just a joke now. Like, Trump's American History would be a great series. That's just like, no, we really want you to host it. Then you don't need research. Just go off the dome. America, go.
By the way, if we're talking about lies, I just want to mention one other set of lies. So there's the lies to protect his incredibly shallow, pathetic ego. And then there's this. I'm not going to read the entire thing. I don't have it in my soul anymore. But he does say at one point, it's all in the third person, by the way. But even, I know that you think he talks in the third person. It's more in the third person than usual. But he says, blah, 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 rigged Biden trial, which President Trump is not allowed to comment on or answer because of the unprecedented and unconstitutional gag order. He has no right to respond. That is just not true. He has a gag order that stops him from attacking a short list of people directly involved in the case. He is under no obligation to not talk about the case. He just can't attack like Stormy Daniels or Michael Cohen or the daughter of the judge. Very reasonable limitations. He can talk about the case. And the weird thing is, he loves talking, well, about everything, but especially about things that have to do with him. So why in this case, if he can't just attack, why would he suddenly opt out of talking about the case? Why is he pretending that he can't talk about the case? I mean, I would argue it's because other than baselessly attacking like Stormy Daniels or the judge or something like that, he doesn't want to have anything to do with the actual allegations or the evidence, and for obvious reasons, because he did it. He did it. He knows we know he did it. He knows that he did it. And so it's so weird that like he's just opting out. And by the way, on the gag order, you know, they had that really contentious hearing earlier this week where the judge declared that his lawyer had lost all credibility. They have another one of those hearings coming up on May 1st for the violations of the gag order that have happened between that hearing about violating the gag order and now. And so more of that to come. What do you think?
Yeah. I talked to Jay Willis yesterday of Balls and Strikes. We talked about the broader Trump legal cases, but one of the things he pointed out, and if you look at all of these cases together and how they're approaching all of these cases, it's just to delay, to delay, to delay. Everything they're doing is to try to push all of these cases back until after the election. And that's really, when you think about it that way, all of this stuff makes sense. It's very easy to abide by a gag order, I guess, for most people. For him, this might be a unique challenge, but his legal team, even just taking that case yesterday on absolute immunity to the Supreme Court, it's all designed to push things back. This, all of these hearings, same thing, push it back. But I do want to point out, the gag order, I guess it could affect the election because, I mean, you think about swing states and the issues that they care about, they're all talking about the judge's daughter. Like that's it is a big divisive issue in this country.
It's a Rust Belt thing, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, they really care about the judge's daughter.
Clean drinking water and the judge's daughter, it rhymes, really, it's a slogan.
Any other thoughts about this before we move on, Francesca?
I mean, like I'll believe it when I see it in terms of actually like putting a gag order on this man, like throw him in jail. Let's go. No. I know we have to move on to another aspect of that, but.
And as of right now, that's not even really being debated. It's just a fine, $1,000 per violation. He'll gladly write that check. He'll truth out a picture of that check. It'll be like Michael Jordan and the sneakers or whatever. It's like it becomes part of the PR to be fined. We're going to move past that to other developments, this time in Tennessee. Take a look at this. That is the Tennessee House earlier this week. You heard the chant, blood on your hands, being chanted by a number of people up there in the visitors boxes. Heads up to any members of the Tennessee legislature, don't take part in those chants because you might be ejected from the legislature. It's a ridiculous place, Tennessee. But the reason that they're all chanting is because a bill was finally passed to address the mass shootings that have happened in the not too distant past in Tennessee, specifically by allowing more guns into schools in Tennessee. In this case, to be wielded by staff and by faculty, who now have the obligation added to the obligation they already had to educate the next generation of Americans. Now, they need to protect those young Americans from madmen and women wielding AR-15s. So that's fun. That bill heads to Governor Bill Lee's desk, where he made clear that he plans to sign it. Take a look at this.
I do plan on signing the legislation, and I think we need to be really clear about what this law does. You're right. Districts have the option to choose. And as has been reported, there are many districts that are considering that option, depending on what happens when the bill gets signed. So there, what's important to me is that we give districts tools and the option to use a tool that will keep their children safe in their schools. There are a multitude of states across the country who have similar types of legislation that allow this because they believe that it will make kids safer in schools. And that's what we want more than anything, is to add an additional tool, an additional option for our kids to be as safe as possible in schools. The vetting that's required, the training that's required, the approval from the district, the approval from local law enforcement. This is an option, and I think it's an important one that districts should have.
You might see that and think that this is all political theater combined with political cowardice. And if you're already thinking that, seeing the little smirk on his face near the end might make your blood boil. But I think he really does care about what he's talking about providing tools and options, but not just to faculty and staff. He also wants to maintain access to tools and options for the next wave of mass shooters. You know, an AR-15 is a great tool if you want to kill as many students as possible, which is why they don't want to do anything to stop murderers from having access to those tools. They want to have the option to have weapons that fit only on a battlefield that instead they can take into a school. And so when a teacher goes through the vetting and decides to have a gun, you know, you can see that as potentially a disaster waiting to happen. But it's brave on some level. It's certainly braver than any Republican politician in Tennessee, because they will be doing more in picking up that gun than any Republican will do to stop kids from being gunned down in the near future. Francesca, what do you think?
I can't get Republicans straight when it comes to teachers. Like, what are they? Are they groomers or are they law enforcement? I forget. Are they teaching critical race theory and how to be a drag queen and how to be gay to their kids? Or are they actually like pointing a gun at their own students and that's all hunky dory? Or is that part of it, right? Like, it's so sick. Like, I want to make fun of this, but it is sick. It is sick if you had family who've been killed in a mass shooting at a school. It is sick that we even say mass shooting at a school, and that there have been many in this country, not just, you know, one, not just the worst one, right? And it like, this will only increase the body count. My brother is a teacher at a public school. Like, in no way, you know, the amount of things that he already has to deal with, the lack of funding, the like trying to get his own school supplies, kids being kids generally, and now, oh yeah, now he, it's on him to protect his class with a gun. Obviously, we know this ends in just more people being shot, but I think what is not being said here is, just like what's not being said when it comes to the amount of violence in the Middle East, the lobby. Where's the lobby? Someone's getting rich on this. No one gets rich off of saving kids' lives. People get rich when more people have guns. That's the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers.
Yeah, this is something they've been pushing for years. I mean, teachers' unions have been fighting against it for as long as I can remember. But this is their solution to school shootings. It's not, let's deal with how these people get guns in the first place, because you'll see them lobby to kill these background checks or shut down the gun show loophole. They don't want that. No, how do we get more guns out there? Like you're saying, Fran, it's just how do you get more people out there that they'll buy these guns and then these teachers have to hold them? The funding thing is just ridiculous. Like you're saying, these people are underappreciated. It's a thankless job. Even in that moment, if there's somebody who comes into the school with an AR-15, and these are handguns they're talking about, and they have to be concealed. The hysteria that'll occur in a school if there's a school shooter.
Yep.
No one in their right mind is gonna be like, okay, well, what's my code for my gun locker? I'm gonna go get this. Think this through. It doesn't make sense. But the responsibility that they're putting now on teachers to deal with this, when you saw in a scenario like Uvalde, or school resource officers and cops and the National Guard or all these different police agencies hid and cowered in the hallway while one kid with an AR-15 stormed the hallways uninterrupted. And you expect one English teacher with a handgun to fight back because the cops are too scared? No, the problem is that weapons of war are on the streets and in the hands of lunatics who then go out and kill people. Deal with that problem. The solution is not arming Miss Reed, the English teacher.
100%. Yeah, and it seems like if you think, okay, try to put yourself in the position of the Republicans in the Tennessee State House. Mm-hmm. It is so hard to believe that this could be a solution to a mass shooting that you are almost left to think they don't think it's a solution to that. So why do it? Well, there are a couple of obvious reasons to do it, even though it won't solve the problem. It lets you pretend to be addressing the problem. It's sort of a get out of having to actually do anything card, but not just in the way that might be obvious. Not just right now. Right now, they do this instead of actually stopping the access to the guns that are the most dangerous. But think about this. Fast forward 3 months, a year, 2 years. Someone goes into a school, shoots up a bunch of people. What do you think will happen when either these politicians or right-wing media finds out that there was a teacher or a staff member at that school who had gone through this process and had the gun, but didn't stop it? Because of course they didn't stop it, because that's an impossible thing to expect of them. But now you have a scapegoat. You have someone you can point to. They should have been a hero. Remember when everybody freaked out? Marjorie Stoneman Douglas about the one guard who theoretically could have done something and that was their job. That was a great scapegoat.
Yeah.
Now you've potentially set up scapegoats in multiple schools.
Right.
It's an investment in cowardice.
What if the child uses the teacher's gun to carry out said mass shooting, right? Yeah. I mean, again, which is way more likely because you've got the presence of a gun in a classroom. You know, look. This is a, like, if we had a functioning UN, this is just classic failed state behavior. Do you know what I'm saying? This is a country overrun with guns and weapons of war. This is a country with more mass shootings per capita than any other country in the world. And now in our places of education, teachers are being asked to carry guns to stop the next. I mean, like, this is true failed state behavior. The wheels have come off this country.
100%. We're gonna take another break. Lots of important news to come to get to on the other side, so don't go anywhere. Welcome back, one and all, to what remains of the Young Turks. Want to let you know that coming up on the other side of this segment, we got more news, don't go anywhere. But then we're gonna have a short break, and then the second hour starts. Brett Ehrlich is going to be here in studio, joined by Ben Glebe and Jackson White. So you're definitely gonna wanna stick around for the entire second hour. But first, we have news. We might get to the lighter news, but we need to start with incredibly serious news. So prepare yourself as we launch into this. Newly released body cam footage shows a black man in Ohio repeatedly telling police that he couldn't breathe as they pinned him to the ground before eventually dying. We are speaking here about 53-year-old Frank Tyson, who had a deadly interaction with the Canton Police Department in Ohio. This is back on April 18th. He apparently crashed his car into a pole. And then police apparently responded to the scene. They found the downed power pole and an unoccupied vehicle with the driver's side door open and an airbag deployed. Now, they spoke to a person who said that the guy who was responsible for the crash was up the street at the Veterans Lodge. Okay, a number of police officers went to that lodge, and that's when the eventually fatal interaction occurred. Obviously, this is very serious, very dark material, so consider yourself warned in terms of the content, but here is the footage.
As officers approach 53-year-old Frank Tyson, a struggle ensues as they try to restrain him.
Get on the ground.
Officers take Tyson down to the ground.
They're gonna kill me.
and begin handcuffing him, with one of the officers appearing to have one of his knees on Tyson's back.
Calm down! Calm down!
As they continue struggling, Tyson can be heard saying he can't breathe.
I can't breathe. You're fine.
Dear God. How many times have we seen tapes of a person predicting that they would be killed in the interaction that was being filmed? He was right. He was going to die, and he died as a result of that. He was eventually taken to a hospital, was pronounced dead. But along the way, it's possible that there was an opportunity to save this man's life. Because later on in the video, he's motionless on the floor. One of the police officers asks if he's calmed down. Another one is quoted as saying he might be out. Knowing what we now know about what happened, that is just so terrible. One of them makes a joke about always wanting to be in a bar fight as he is lying unconscious on the ground in the waning moments of his life. After more than 5 minutes pass, one of the officers checks his pulse. 5 minutes of him laying motionless. They check his pulse. 3 minutes after that, they begin CPR. And shockingly, after waiting 8 minutes as this man lays there, it didn't save his life. He was taken, as I said, to the hospital and was eventually pronounced dead. Now, we don't know exactly what was going on with him. We don't know exactly what the cause of death was. An autopsy has been conducted, but because he died in police custody, it has not yet been made public. It will be up to the prosecutor to decide if and when that actually happens. So it is possible that there could be other information that influenced this outcome. But for right now, we saw a lot, we've heard a lot, we now know a lot about what happened, and it is unfortunately an all too familiar story. Francesca, what's your reaction to that?
This man was in a car accident. He was seeking help, and when the police arrived, they killed him. I mean, when you begin that footage, they're coming upon him. Is he thrashing? Does he have a weapon pulled? He doesn't want to be arrested. He's just been in a car accident. I mean, this again, you talk about why people don't trust police. Here is evidence number, 20,506. Like, how many times do we have to see the same thing? And yet you're told that no. These people want to defund the police. Oh my God. Meanwhile, again, the movement that popped off in 2020. Where's the actual political impact? Like, where has anyone responded to the cries of the American people to say, we are over-policed, we do not want anyone to die at the hands of police, please stop. Nothing's happened. Joe Biden says, we gotta fund the police. Remember that whole fun thing? Cory Booker, senator, says, nobody wants to defund the police, as if defunding the police was the craziest thing imaginable. That trying to have better cops, a better police department, a public safety, real public safety, was the wildest thing. And all it has to come down to is also what your experience with the cops are. Here's a black man, he's 53 years old. His experience with the cops were his death. But meanwhile, if you're a, rich, white, homeowner who calls the cops because someone's digging in your trash, what is your experience of the cops gonna be? Most people love the cops, why? Because the cops are not in your neighborhood. If they were, you would understand.
This is reminiscent of Eric Garner, who had a similar video. It was, I can't breathe, and he's in a chokehold, and they just killed him. And then when people, using his last words, tried to use that moment to talk about police brutality, including making shirts, which some NBA players wore that said, I can't breathe. NYPD responded by wearing shirts that said, I can breathe. And it's just a total disregard for human life. They don't care even when they're the ones doing the killing. And let's just say, so I think Francesca, your example, that could be the scenario. We need to learn more, but let's just say it's not. Let's say he was driving drunk. Let's say he hit a flagpole and then he went into that bar to either mask that he was drinking or something. Who knows? Maybe he had a concussion. In any of these circumstances, the punishment, as far as I know, and I'm not a lawyer, the punishment is not execution on the spot by a cop. And that's where these things go awry. You're going to now see Canton police justify lethal force. They're going to talk about how he came at them and it was self-defense. But the timeline that John laid out, to me, illustrates negligence. 5 minutes before they even checked his pulse, and then another 3 minutes before they even did something about it. That is heinous and deliberate.
Yeah, and those sorts of, like, it was 8 minutes before they tried to help or whatever, before they even checked. Like, that is one of the constants in stories like this.
Yeah.
And I don't understand how, like, is it inconvenient to you to make sure that the person didn't just die? Are you busy? Like, did you get a phone call? Like, what exactly is stopping you from briefly checking to see if you just killed a person? And I try to remember that obviously the interactions where a person is brutalized and then they vocalize that they literally can't breathe, that they're terrified of dying, where the cop backs off and doesn't finish the job, granted, those don't make news. So it's possible that there are people, cops, who have learned from the fact that this, basically this exact same thing has now happened many times. But I feel like we could go longer as a society between them. Like, mm-hmm. I just don't understand. I know that, like, everybody's busy, everybody's caught up in their day, but if you're a cop and you get in this situation, when you're pressing your knee into the back of someone's neck, can you stop for a second and think, is this person about to die? Am I about to be the next cop that's done this? And I know that there's gotta be some that have learned new training or just personal accountability or responsibility. But there's gonna be a next one, and I don't know, maybe it's in your town. You're watching it right now. Maybe a cop in your town will do this. And I just don't know why they can't stop and think, like, maybe I can alter my behavior a little bit and a person doesn't have to die. Even just to protect yourself and your career, a little bit more responsibility, a little bit more awareness, because this person's life mattered, it had value. And again, we'll see if they ever release more information from this, but for right now, just put it in the file with all the other instances like this, where people needlessly died because they had the worst day of their life, they had an accident, they had a breakdown, they drank too much, whatever. All things that could be bad, but shouldn't necessarily result in you dying. I think that's unfortunate all the time we have. So we're gonna have to set aside this last story, but don't worry, there is so much great content coming up in the next hour. For now though, as always, great to have you here. Great to have you here, especially.
Yeah,
wow. Thank you.
Quick shot at Francesca.
Everybody,
before we go.
Listen to the, I was doing the Bituation Room, which is my podcast, and everyone should listen to it.
Anyway, go listen to the Bituation. I hear it's great and everything. It has fascinating guests and it's really funny and great segments. That's what I hear. But anyway, thank you, Francesca.
Thank you,
Jordan. Great to have you both here. Mm-hmm. Stay tuned. More to come on the other side of this.